It's my pleasure to introduce Patty O from Los Angeles.
My name's Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober and be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard somebody the other night say that they went to speaker meetings to be entertained. If you intend to be entertained here tonight, you might be in the wrong place. I'm going to tell you a sad, desperate, tearful story of alcoholism and how I survived it and came to Alcoholics Anonymous.
This always happens.
Are you getting fresh here or what? I'd like to tell you I was a Kansas City housewife. I sat on the sofa and drank a little light wine. One day I burnt the toast and realized my life was unmanageable and came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I'd like to tell you. I was responsible one time for a house fire that gutted the entire inside of a house, and I imagined someplace in that house there was a loaf of bread. So I believe that I did at one time burn the toast. But it wasn't enough to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome those of you who are new here. I'd like to ask you when you go home tonight to get a piece of paper and a pencil and write down what it is you expect to have happen to you here in Alcoholics Anonymous, what it is you want out of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and then just put the piece of paper away somewhere. And next year when you're taking a cake for 1 year of sobriety, take that piece of paper out and look at it and find out that if God had let you have it your way, you'd have shortchanged yourself. If God had let me have it my way, I would have shortchanged myself, because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous only to stay out of jail. That's the only thing I wanted out of this deal. I wasn't looking for anything else. If God had let me have it my way, I would have shortchanged myself, because I found things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't even know existed before I came here. My life is full of things today that I would have had no way of planning for because I didn't know anything about them. The God that takes care of me is very gentle and very loving, and the things that are going on in my life today are beyond my wildest imagination, and I certainly have a wild imagination. One of the things I'm grateful for is I am not from Los Angeles. I'm from Dana Point, which is in southern Orange County. It's the ghetto of Laguna Beach, if any of you are familiar with that area. It's been hot there, unusually hot there. They tell me we have an ocean breeze. So far I haven't caught it, but I think that it is around there somewhere. It's heat. I have a raging headache right now, if anybody wants to feel sorry for me. Oh, no, I don't take anything, please. Do you have a Valium? Oh. That's the thing that I like best in Alcoholics Anonymous is the laughter. It was laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous that started to break through the walls that I had built up. It was your laughter that started to... That was the beginning of my recovery. I believe what it says in the book. I believe that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. I don't know about any of you, but I had all of the misery and all of the despair and all of the pain when I was out on the street that I could possibly endure. I believe that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And if you're new tonight, just sit back and let the laughter begin to heal you. If you're not so new and you're in pain, just sit back and let the laughter heal you. It's guaranteed to work if it can work for somebody like me. I'm going to tell you a little bit about where I came from. You probably don't care. It's important to me, though. I heard a speaker the other night at a meeting say, I was born. And I always get nervous when speakers start out by saying, I was born, especially if they're old. You know, you're going to have to listen. You're going to have to listen for a long time, you know, and what if they're boring, or what if you have a date after the meeting, or what if you want to go do something, you know, and this old fart is up there, and it was... So it makes me a little nervous, so I'm going to tell you, I was born February 3rd, 1949 in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. Up until that moment, everything in my life was fine. Up until that moment, I had everything I needed. It was enough, and it was the right kind. From that moment on, I never had enough, and it was never the right kind. And I was always searching for something more, and I was always looking for that thing if I only had. And it never satisfied me, and it was never enough until just recently in Alcoholics Anonymous. The other interesting thing that happened to me when I was born, my father left. He abandoned us, and I assumed the responsibility and the guilt for that. I don't know if anybody in this room knows anything about guilt, but I was born guilty. I came out of the chute guilty, and I lived my whole life guilty. Until just recently in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to get beyond that somehow. My mother remarried when I was 4. She had come to California on a vacation and told my brother and I she'd bring us back a souvenir from California, and she did. It was a little more than we had expected, or... My mother and I'm going to talk about my parents a little bit only because they were in my life. If the mailman had been in my life a little more often, I'd probably talk about him too. But these folks that were in my life, my parents, I learned a lot from them. I learned about honesty from them, and they weren't blatantly dishonest. But what they taught me about honesty, I can kind of sum up for you in how they met. My mother was in Los Angeles. My stepfather, who I will refer to as my father because that's the only father I've ever known, lived in Los Angeles. And he thought that she had money because she told him that her father owned a grocery store in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. And my grandfather owned a grocery store. It was about a quarter of the size of this room. It wasn't a big money-making business. And she thought he had money because he told her he'd take her to Acapulco on their honeymoon. And he didn't lie to her. 2 hours after they were married, they were in the Acapulco room in downtown L.A. And that's what I learned honesty was. I tell you just enough, and I let you jump to your own conclusion, and you're responsible for whatever it is you believe. And that was what I learned honesty was about. We moved to California right after my parents were married, and I learned about love from those two people. They told me that they loved me. They told me that they were raising me with love. Any more of their love and I'd have died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and mentally abusive. Any more of that love and I'd have died. At 5 years old, I made a conscious decision that I would never love another human being. That if I loved you, I had to hurt you. And if I let you love me, you were going to hurt me. And I never said the words, I love you, to another human being. I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that women particularly, if they use the words, I love you, and if they're properly timed, they're followed by money, property, and prestige. But I never knew that. Gratefully, God never struck me with the insanity of marriage. Instead, I chose to steal my money, property, and prestige. The consequences of that seemed a lot less terminal. It wasn't quite as big a deal. But that's what I thought love was. We were raised Catholic as much as that's possible. And I never quite understood this part of my story, and I like to share it in case somebody here can explain it to me after the meeting. My mother was going to hell for remarrying. And because she remarried so that my brother and I could have a father, my brother and I had to go to confession every Saturday afternoon. Now, I never understood that, but my brother and I would go off to confession every Saturday, and I was only a little kid. I wasn't into any heavy sinning yet. So I would go Saturday after Saturday after Saturday, and I would tell the priest the same boring sins week after week after week, and I knew he was bored with it because I was bored with it. So one day I decided to do this thing that I like to call creative confession. I did some reading, I got some magazines, I took some notes, I studied some things, and I put a little confession together. And at 12 years old, I went to confession on Saturday, and I did my creative confession. And my whole intent, the only reason I was doing it, was to put a spark in this man's afternoon, just to do something for another human being, kind of lighten him up a little bit. And it worked. I have to tell you, he was breathing heavy by the time I got through. He had said, my God, a number of times. And I left the confessional really feeling good. I had done something for another human being. Now, if I had continued to do the penance that he gave me, I would still be going to Mass every day, and I would still be saying three rosaries every day. There's no question in my mind. But I felt good because I had done something for another human being. I have to tell you, too, that I'm 34 years old, and I still haven't done some of the things I told the priest I did that day when I was... I have in the last year, though, done a few of them, and I'm really sorry I've waited so long. But I felt good about that. I felt good about doing something for another human being, and I carried that feeling all the way to the next day. And the next day we went to Mass, and if you're a good Catholic family, you hang out in front of the church after Mass. That way everybody else knows that you're a good Catholic family. So we were hanging out after Mass the next day, and the priest came out, and he told my father the things I had told him in the confessional. And my father took me home and beat me, and that meant he loved me. I understood that. But I learned from that experience never to trust another human being, that if I told you anything about me, you were going to use it against me. If you knew anything about me, you were going to hurt me with it. And so I never told you another thing about who I was. And my whole life was a series of building walls to keep you out. Building walls to keep you from getting too close so that you couldn't hurt me. And those walls worked really well. And the thing that I never knew about those walls is that those walls that kept you out made me a prisoner inside. And I knew isolation and loneliness, and I didn't know that's what I knew. God was very gentle with me. God let me find alcohol when I was 13 years old. I believe today that if I hadn't found alcohol, I would have had to blow my brains out. In retrospect, I don't think a human being can live in that isolation, that loneliness for long without something else. And my first drink of alcohol was, I was on a camping trip with a group of girls. We were camped at the beach in Oceanside, and I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I can't even tell you where that bottle came from, but somehow I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And I remember when we got into the tent that night being excited about having it, but having absolutely no idea what it would do. And I took it out of my pillowcase and I asked if anybody in the tent wanted any of it. And none of them did. And the reason they gave me for not wanting any of it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, so what? And I took the top off and I drank half of it. And nothing got different and nothing changed. And so I drank the second half of it. And nothing got different and nothing changed. Now that was the end of my social drinking. I never once after that day offered anybody a drink out of my bottle. I was, in fact, I was in jail one time and I had a bottle of real alcohol, which is sometimes difficult to come by. And one of the criminals wanted some of it and I said no, and she broke the bones in my left hand. And she asked for it again and I said no, and she broke the bones in my right hand. And those criminals don't like rejection. They're really funny about that. And I went to the infirmary and I had my arms cast and I went back with that arrogance that only we as alcoholics have, and I took the top off of that bottle and I drank it down. I never once offered you a drink out of my bottle. Anyway, that day when I was 13, I drank that vodka and absolutely nothing happened. And about 15 minutes after I drank it, I had to go to the bathroom, which is, I have to tell you, my one character defect. I still have weak kidneys. I'm a little concerned about this bathroom situation here. I do, however, know how to use a urinal, so I may be all right. It's one of the advantages of being a female alcoholic. We're resourceful. Anyway, I got out of the tent, and I was going down to the little outhouse there on the beach, and I was kind of shuffling my feet. I was a little disappointed that nothing had happened here. And I went into the outhouse and I went to the bathroom, and when I got done, I went to get up off the toilet. I realized I was absolutely, completely, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move my eyelids. I didn't think I was breathing. There was a point I didn't think my heart was beating anymore. And I was overcome with an absolute sense of fear. And the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, later in my drinking career, I discovered that two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But I didn't know that then. So I got all the energy I could get from anywhere in my body. I got it all kind of in one central location. And when it seemed to be in one location, I just fell face forward off the toilet, out the door, and into the sand. And I started crawling back to the little tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my whole problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. I could have had this little fantasy that I was in the Marines and I was being dive-bombed and I was trying to get back to the foxhole, and it could have been a lot of fun. Now, in my own defense, I have to tell you, it's a little difficult to get up a good attitude when your pants are down at your ankles. I had started to throw up, and I couldn't quite get through it or around it. And under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to get up a good attitude. Somehow I got back to the tent. To this day, I don't know how. I fell in. I passed out. When I came to in the morning and my eyes started to clear, I noticed there wasn't anybody in the tent with me. And I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared a little more, and I realized I had thrown up all night. And I had hit the top of the tent and the sides of the tent. And I didn't want to be in there either, and I got the hell out. And fortunately, it was my parents' tent, so I just kind of folded it up and took it home and put it in the garage. Remember, a couple weeks later, we had a big family camping trip, and I don't remember what was going on in my life, but it was really, really important, and I couldn't quite make it on the camping trip with my family. And I remember they bought a new tent right after that, though. Anyway, that was my first drink of alcohol, and I loved it. It was the absolutely most marvelous thing that had ever happened to me. It was the most wonderful experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body every day after that. Not a day went by that I didn't put some kind of alcohol into my body. And I didn't always drink the kind of things that you would consider a beverage. I was 13 years old. Sometimes it's a little tough to get a hold of alcohol. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. We lived in a small town. We had a little neighborhood market. I used to buy it by the six-pack. Something about vanilla extract, the first five bottles were fine. Halfway through the sixth bottle, I would all of a sudden remember what happened when I finished a six-pack of vanilla extract. Once you finish the sixth bottle, my heart would start to pound. I would start to perspire, and then I would be freezing, and my legs would get weak, and they wouldn't hold me up, and I'd fall to the ground. And the first 10 minutes were absolute hell. If you live through the first 10 minutes, it's a wonderful high. But I never remembered that first 10 minutes until I was halfway through the sixth bottle. And I believe, for me, I believe that's the insanity of the disease of alcoholism. It isn't the things that I do after I drank. It's what my head did or didn't tell me before I picked up that first drink. And my head never reminded me of that first 10 minutes until I was well into the sixth bottle. And that's what I believe the insanity of the disease of alcoholism is. I remember one day the manager of that little market called me over, and he said, "Patty," he said, "I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore, because I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." I went away to school. I went to San Diego State, and I did well in school. I have to tell you that I graduated with a 3.8 grade point average. And the only reason I tell you that is that almost killed me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I took the classes for my master's degree there, and I did very well academically. And that almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I came to you people, I knew I was too smart to be an alcoholic. I had graduated with a 3.8 grade point average, and I had taken the classes for my master's degree, and nobody who's that brilliant could possibly be an alcoholic. If you're sitting here tonight and you think you're too smart to be an alcoholic and you're in a little bit of pain, that might be why. I almost died in Alcoholics Anonymous believing I was too smart to be here. Also, I have to tell you, my sponsor insists that I tell this, and I don't know why. It humiliates me. We figured it out one day, and I spent more days in jail than I did in class the 4 years that I was going to college. So it's not that I'm so brilliant, it's that I test well, I think. Because I always got out, I always let me out 2 or 3 days before finals, and I went in and did well. So I have to tell you that I'm not as brilliant as I like to think I am. And you can thank my sponsor for that humiliation. I left San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. I truly believe that was why I was leaving San Diego. I was going to leave San Diego and go to Chico, California. I had a friend who lived there, and she didn't know anything about me, and I was going to go there, and I was going to start my business life. And And I thought I was leaving San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. I did not think I was leaving San Diego because I had a drunk driving assault charge pending. I had a roommate who was a little annoyed with me. I don't know about any of you, but if they and them would have been consistent, I would have been okay. If they and them would have had their acts together, I'd have been okay. But I had this roommate. I was a bar drinker. I did all the things that women bar drinkers do. I did a lot of the things that men bar drinkers do. I was never particular about my behavior. And I went to bars to drink. I have really been disappointed since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out what I missed out there. There was a lot of action going on in those bars that I didn't know anything about because I went to the bars to drink. And I would be sitting at the bar drinking and some fellow, nice young man, sitting next to me. And if this offends anybody, you deserve it, I guess. The men that drank in the bars that I drank in were not very creative. They had two basic lines. My wife doesn't understand, and I don't have any place to stay tonight. And that was it. That was it. And so one of these guys had come on with one of his big creative lines, and you know the compassion that I had when I did my creative confession? I was still had a little flicker of that. So some guy would come on with his line about his wife not understanding, and I'd say, listen, you can go home with me tonight, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. And so the bar would close, and being the lady of my word, I would take this guy home with me, and we would get to my house, and I would point to the bedroom over here on the right, and I'd say, you go on in there, I have to go to the bathroom. And he'd go into the bedroom on the right, and I would go into my bedroom on the left, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now... Now, some nights, that was okay with her. Some nights, she didn't mind that at all. Other nights, she would get really upset about it, and I would suddenly, there'd be all this banging on my bedroom door, which I, of course, had locked, and they'd be banging and screaming on my bedroom door, and for God's sake, I had 7 o'clock classes. Now, I had to get some rest here, and I didn't... And if she would have been consistent, if it would have always been okay or never been okay, I would have been all right. But her you'd have drank, too, if you lived with her, her inconsistency... And I didn't think I was leaving San Diego because she was upset with me. I truly believed I was leaving because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. There's also a woman in San Diego I pray for this lady nightly that she has found Al-Anon. I was speaking at a meeting in San Diego one night, and I thought she walked in the back of the room, and I hit the floor. And the secretary of the meeting was on his way to call the paramedics before he realized I hadn't fainted back there. I thought this lady had come in. She was a little annoyed at me. And I have to tell you, there was this one night in the bar, this guy had a different line. And I didn't understand this. To this day, I don't understand this. This guy said to me, I'm too drunk to drive home. I said, hello. I always drove better when I had a few drinks. And so I said, listen, I'll give you a ride home. So I got him in my car, and he told me how to get to his house. And we finally got there, and he said, why don't you come in for a drink? Well, I don't want to be rude, so I said, okay, fine. And we get in the house, and he says, now you have to be very quiet. Well, I figured he had a roommate like mine who was real inconsistent, so that was okay. And we got our drinks, and we went down the hall into this bedroom. And my second clue that things might not have been on the up and up were that there were two twin beds in that bedroom. But I want to tell you, that guy got those beds together so fast that I hardly noticed there'd been two of them. And we were in there for one thing was leading to another. I used to know what it led to, but... one thing was leading to something else anyway, and all of a sudden I had to go to the bathroom, and so I get up and I go down to the bathroom, and now I am ready to play. And I get back to the bedroom door, and I ran across the bedroom floor. I did this Tarzan yell as I leaped into the air... and landed into bed, and I landed into bed. This woman started screaming so loud. And there I was, stark naked in bed with his wife. And next thing I knew, he was at the doorway, stark naked, explaining to her that I was his cousin. He hadn't seen me in 10 years. And we were trying to get reacquainted. And all I wanted to do was get out of the bed. And this lady was looking for me to kill me. And all I had done was drive her husband home. She should have been grateful. And I didn't think that was had anything to do with why I was leaving San Diego. I thought I was leaving because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. And I left San Diego for Chico, and I loaded up. I had two cases of beer, and I had two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got 60 miles north of San Diego to Santa Ana, and I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I turned off at the first street off-ramp. I have a sense I pulled into the parking lot of the sleaziest bar without even looking for it. I walked into this place. There was sawdust on the floor. Somebody had thrown up several weeks before that, and they hadn't quite cleaned it up yet. It was smoke-filled. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. I sat down, and I ordered a drink, and that's as far north as I ever got, 60 miles from where I'd started from. Alcohol controlled where I would work, where I would live, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from, and I had absolutely no idea. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I was in an accident one time. You guys have a lot of trees here, so you're probably used to them, but we don't have a lot of trees in Southern California. And the ones we do have a tendency to move, to jump right out in front of your car. And I was driving home from work late one night, and this tree jumped right out in front of my car. And I ran into it, and apparently I screamed, and then hit my chin on the steering wheel and bit down. And I got out of my, turned my car off. It had made, was like a little accordion. Turned it off, got out of it and locked it, because I didn't want to tempt anybody who was stealing it. There was a lot of blood. I thought I had a bloody nose. I walked up to the hospital. Now, you know, God has always been very gentle with me, and I never knew it till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But that night, in retrospect, that night was evident of God working in my life, and I never had a clue. I got up to the hospital, and a friend of mine was working in the admitting room of emergency, and I said, "Connie, can you help me?" And she turned around and looked and started to scream. And they came and got me and laid me down in the back in the little emergency room. Well, apparently the shift that was on was almost ready to go off. So they didn't want to start with me. And the shift that was coming on hadn't clocked in yet, so they didn't want to start with me. So they just kind of left me back there. And because Connie was a friend of mine, she came back to talk to me. And she couldn't look at me, so she had a little curtain pulled around, and we were talking. And I stopped talking, and she knew something was wrong. And she looked in, and I had bitten my tongue. And when they laid me down, the blood started draining, and I was drowning on my own blood. And she started to scream, and they came in and did whatever they do to you, which I don't ever want to ask because I don't think it's very nice. But they came in, and because God was working in my life at that time, I didn't die. If she hadn't been there, if a friend of mine hadn't been there, I would have died on the change of the shifts. And the shift coming on would have come in, and I'd have been dead. And they'd have written dead on arrival, and they'd have done whatever they do with dead on arrivals. And I'm going to tell you, I'd have been a little pissed off. But they put 140 stitches in my tongue trying to save it. They admitted me into the hospital. They put IVs in me because I couldn't swallow my own saliva. So they put IVs in me to give me medication to feed me and to keep liquids in my body so I wouldn't dehydrate. And once they got me hooked up and they left the room, I unplugged the IVs and I got out of the bed. Now, I don't know why they charge you so much to stay in the hospital and they only give you the front of a gown. But in the front of that gown, I walked out of my room, and I knew that hospital very well, and I walked out of the lobby and into the doctor's dining room, and I got a bottle of booze, and I went back to my room. And I rang for the nurse, and I was very indignant because my IVs had fallen out. And she hooked me back up, and she left the room, and I couldn't swallow my own saliva. And I took a teaspoon and I poured a teaspoon of booze. I put it as far back in my throat as I could without gagging. I tipped it over and let it run down. And I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that at 13 years old I had put alcohol into an alcoholic body. And from that day on I had no choice. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result of one more drunk driving assault charge. You know, I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that you can get picked up for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got picked up for drunk driving assault because I had a nasty habit of leaping out of the car quickly. And there's always either two sheriffs or two highway patrolmen. There's always two of them when they stop you. And when you come out of the car kicking and screaming and swinging, then they call a backup and there's four of them. And four against one, I never won. But I never learned that I wasn't going to win, and I always got picked up for drunk driving assault. And I didn't know that had anything to do with my drinking. I thought it had to do with my driving. And so then I would walk home. And on walking home, I would get picked up for drunken public assault. And I didn't know that had anything to do with my drinking. And so one night I decided just to kind of hide out in the bar and stay there where it was safe. And that night I got picked up for breaking and entering assault. And I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that you can just get picked up for drunk driving. And I had to come here to find out that they can put the handcuffs on you without drawing blood. I never knew that before I came to alcohol. It's a fine thing to know. If you don't kick and scream and fight, they don't draw blood. But I got picked up in Orange County for one more drunk driving assault charge. They put me in a cell with criminals, which I didn't particularly like. I decided what I would do that night was organize a jailbreak. I explained to the criminal women that were in there that we were going to take our coffee cups and we were going to bang it on the bars. And when the marshal came around to see what was going on, I was going to throw my arm out around the bars, get her around the neck, get her keys, and we were going to get out of there. And I explained this plan to the criminals. And I heard something that I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. This woman looked at me and she said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" And I said, "Fine, y'all stay here. I'm getting out." And I got my coffee cup and I was going like a mad woman. Now, there's a couple problems with styrofoam cups. First off, they don't make a lot of noise. And second off, when you're running them along the bars tend to eat them up. And when it gets to your knuckles, it gets painful. And when it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. Now, for some reason, they released me that night on an OR, and I hadn't been released from jail on an OR in a very long time, and I knew they were making a mistake, but I wasn't going to be the one to tell them about it. And they released me, and they took me to the telephone, and they told me I could make one telephone call, and I stood at the phone for 5 minutes, and I couldn't think of one person who I could consider a friend that I could call to come pick me up. And I certainly couldn't call anybody in my family to come get me, and it took 5 minutes of standing there before finally the name of a woman who had worked for me at one time went through my head, and I called her up. And I didn't ask her to come pick me up. I told her to come pick me up at Orange County Jail. And I knew isolation and loneliness, and I didn't know that's what I knew. And she came and picked me up, and she took me to my car. And when we got there, she said, "Patty, I don't ever want to see you again. I don't want to hear from you, and I don't want to hear about you. And as far as I'm concerned, you just simply don't exist." And I gave her one of these, and I said, "Fine, I'll do it myself." And I had lived my whole life believing that if I needed anything done, then I would do it. And if I couldn't do it, it didn't need to get done. And I didn't need you, and I didn't need they, and I didn't need them. And she drove off. And I have to tell you that lady today is a very good friend of mine. I've been invited to her house for dinner on a number of occasions. I was invited to attend her daughter's wedding. About 6 months ago, she found out that she had a cancerous growth in her face, and they were going to have to operate, and they didn't know what the results of that were going to be. And she called me up, and she asked me if I would be in the recovery room when she came to, because she said she needed somebody there that had a conscious contact with the gentle and loving God, and that she needed somebody there who was positive, and she needed that kind of energy in the recovery room. And she said, "You're the only person I can think of who has that kind of energy. And I'm sure that if she was here tonight, she would thank you for that. Because of myself, that was impossible. I was a lady who just a few years before that she had never wanted to see and didn't want to hear about in alcohol. Now, I didn't come here for that. I didn't come here so that I could be in the recovery room when a friend of mine came out. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous simply to stay out of jail. I'd like to tell you that I went to AA right after that, but I didn't. In retrospect, I can tell you that the next 3 months of my drinking were the most urgent, desperate drinking I had ever done. I didn't drink any more. I couldn't possibly have drank any more of a quantity. At the end of my drinking, I was drinking from 6 in the morning till 4 in the morning. I was one of those people that came to at 6 late. I never knew what I was late for, but I was late. And I drank until I passed out at 4 in the morning. And the last 2 years of my drinking were like that. But those last 3 months, there was an urgency and a desperation that I had never known before. And I went to court on that drunk driving assault charge, and the judge was going to sentence me to 5 to 10 years in jail because of my prior arrest record. And I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that's not adequate birth control. And My son had spent the first 11 months of his life in one of those little plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch them. And I would get him up in the morning, whether he wanted to get up or not, and put him in that thing and take him down to the bar and sit him on the pool table. He's going to be 9 years old in November, and he'd like to thank you for my sobriety, mostly because he's probably a little too big for one of those plastic things anymore. But I tried to use him to stay out of jail, and the judge told me that I was an unfit mother, and he was going to put my son in a foster home. And I didn't believe I was an unfit mother. I had that kid with me every day. I didn't leave him at home with incompetent babysitters. And I really believed that that made me a fit mother, and this man was going to put my son in a foster home. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on his face changed, and the tone of his voice changed, and he looked at me and he said, "I don't think this is going to do you any good, but I'm going to give you one more chance." And he offered me an alternative, and part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what ANA was going to do to me or for me. I thought it was maybe kind of like the PTA or something, as something I would just have to endure. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on October 4th, 1975, and I haven't had a drink of alcohol, and I haven't used any mind-altering chemicals since then, and I don't know why. I didn't go to AA to get sober. I didn't even know you didn't drink here until about halfway through my first meeting. And I want to tell you, I was a little annoyed by it. Certainly frustrated me a little. I couldn't figure out what I was going to do with all my time if I wasn't going to drink. The other thing I heard in that first meeting was that the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. God knew I needed to have the answers. And I have to tell you, I was a little annoyed when I got home that night. I read the book. Not only could I not find the answers, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I'm a thief. I have a record. I have a record for Grand Theft Auto and thieves. It's humiliating to a thief to have stolen the wrong book. I went to my second meeting. Oh, they told me on my little court program I had to go to 2 meetings a week. So I thought, geez, I'm going to have to give up 2 nights a week, and I don't want to miss anything good on TV. So on the way home from that first meeting, I stopped and stole a TV guide because I wanted to check out when was the next available night I could come be with you people. And I took the TV guide home and I analyzed it. I got some legal size sheets of paper. I wrote down every day of the week. I wrote down all of the programs, and I gave them all little ratings. I added up the columns to... Now, this was like a 2-hour process of analyzing the TV guide, and never once in that 2 hours did it ever occur to me that I didn't own a TV. That thought never went through my head. But through my analyzing the TV guide, I found out that the next possible night I could come be with you was on Wednesday. So on Wednesday night, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. I looked around the room and I could not figure out what it was that you thought you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. Some of you had nice jewelry. I knew how to get that. I still have 2 rings that I'm waiting for people to claim. If you stood next to me at the Lord's Prayer and if your ring was a little bit loose, it was mine. Some of you had nice cars. I knew how to get those. Some of you had nice spouses. I knew how to get those. I could not figure out what it was you had that you was so hot that I should be willing to go any length to get it. And then I saw him. There was a small discussion meeting. There was a man sitting in that meeting. He was a skinny little dude. He had a bald head. He wore baggy pants and a little thin belt. He had tennis shoes with no shoelaces, only had holes where the shoelaces should be. And he nodded out during the meeting. And I thought, I want what he has. Because I figured this guy was shooting heroin, because folks who shoot heroin nod out. And if I had to do this thing and not drink, I wanted to do it his way. So I found out where he worked, and I went the next day to his office in Laguna Beach. I parked 6 blocks away from his office because I did not want anybody to know that I was going to talk to an alcoholic. Now, by this time, I was throwing up in your living room. I would walk home and I'd get tired and I'd come sleep in your backyards. If you didn't have patio furniture, though, I always left you a nasty little note that anyone who lived in a tract home really ought to have patio furniture, and I thought it was rather disgusting. I slept in your cars. I was visibly doing all of those things that we as alcoholics do, and yet I didn't want anybody to know that I was going to talk to an alcoholic. So I snuck down to this guy's office, and I went in there and I said, "Dick, I said, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he said, Patty, he said, if you'll go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and don't drink, he said, I'll guarantee you, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my sex life would get better, my relationships would get better, my job situation would get better, my family life would get better. He didn't tell me any of that stuff would get better, and I'm grateful because none of it has. But it's all gotten different. And I can stand here tonight, and I can tell you that I've never had it so good. I can stand here tonight, and in my toes I know that I've never had it so good, and I wouldn't have planned it this way for myself. Because you see this thing in my head that tells me if it's good for me or bad for me, that thing's broken. And when something's going on that I think's good for me, it generally turns out to be bad for me. And if I think something's going on that's bad for me, it generally turns out to be good for me. You know, so I don't know good from bad, but I sure do know different. And my life has been different since I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why I believed him, but I believed him. And I hadn't believed a human being in a very long time. And I have to tell you, that man was 32 years sober, which shows you what my judgment of people was like. And the reason he nodded out during meetings is that he had something inside that I didn't even know anything about. He had a serenity and a peace inside. He was right with himself. And because of that, he could nod out during meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that as long as I have the privilege of sharing in meetings, that I never forget to carry the message that he carried to me. And I'll tell the newcomers one more time that if you go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and don't drink, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. When I was a little over a year sober, a man who had been sober for about 20 days came into the Canyon Club, and he had drank that day. And I talked to him, and I don't like newcomers. I mean, first off, they don't stay sober and they don't follow direction. I know that from my own experience. I stayed sober, but I certainly didn't follow direction. But this guy came in, and I talked to him for about 45 minutes, and then one more time I had to go to the bathroom, and I got up to go to the bathroom. When I came back, he was gone, and I asked where he went. And somebody said that he had left, and I went out into the parking lot, and he was in his car, and I asked him if he was okay, and he said he was. And he said he was going to go home and sleep it off. And I said, well, I hope so, because I love you. And it was the first time in my whole life that I ever said the words, I love you. And I didn't know what they meant, but I knew how it felt, and it felt good. And as he drove off, I stood in the parking lot and cried, and I hadn't cried since I was 8 years old. And that line in chapter 5 that it says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. That line went through my head. And I knew that if I was to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have to give myself completely to the simple program. And for me, that meant working those 12 suggested, had better steps exactly the way they're written in the book. That I couldn't interpret them to fit my own needs. That I had to work them exactly the way it says in the book. And I began to do that. And I wish I could tell you I did it gracefully, but I didn't. I never worked one step until my back was against the wall and it was do it or die. And when my back was against the wall and it was do it or die, I worked the next step. And then I would get the relief, and the promise in the book came true. And I don't know, we hear a lot of times about the promises. And when we hear about the promises, we're talking about the promises that come with step 9. But I found in my book, there's a promise for working each and every one of those steps. And those things started happening in my life as I would work the steps. I have to stop, and I'm just barely getting sober here. I'm not going to be able to tell you about how I skyrocketed. I have to tell you, for those of you who have been around for a while, my recovery has been very slow. I haven't done anything in a big hurry, and I'm grateful that it's been that way, because everything that's happened to me in my recovery is mine. I came to believe on that night that my sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God, because I never planned to go a day without drinking. I never planned to go one 24-hour period without drinking, and so my sobriety was a gift. Recovery for me had to be a choice. I had to choose to recover, and I have to continue to participate in my recovery on a daily basis. And that's just how it works for me, and it seems that when I'm doing that on a daily basis, my life goes very smoothly. And in working those 12 steps of recovery, a really interesting thing happened. As a practicing, now I don't know why we call it practicing, I did it really well. But as a practicing alcoholic, I ended up in that place that we as alcoholics end up in. I ended up in that pit of despair. I ended up in that dark, gloomy, dismal place of alcoholism, way down there below the ground somewhere. And somehow, in working those 12 steps of recovery and working the first 9 steps, I came out of that pit and I came onto solid ground and I got to a place where I was eyeball to eyeball with my fellow man. And in working steps 10 through 12, I've continued to grow spiritually and I've continued to become the kind of person that God intended to me for me to be. And in working those steps of recovery and practicing those principles in all of my affairs, my relationship with God is right. And because my relationship with God is right, my relationship with you is right. And because my relationship with you is right, for the very first time in my whole life, my relationship with me is right. And because my relationship with me is right, everything in my life today is enough, and it's the right kind. Because my relationship with us is right, I have the privilege today of loving you. And better yet, I have the privilege of allowing you to love me exactly the way you want to. Because my relationship with us is right, I can give you the dignity to love me the way that you want to love me, not the way that I always thought I needed to be loved. And I never came to Alcoholics Anonymous to learn how to love. I came here simply to stay out of jail. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. My son today is my very best friend. We have a very loving relationship. He still won't go out and get a job, which I can't quite understand, but he was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how to love him, and I brought him here to you, and you loved him. I believe that our children had the worst of our alcoholism, and I believe they deserve the best of our recovery. And I brought my son here to you, and you loved him when I didn't know how. And when you could, you started to love me, and then you taught us how to love one another. And you taught me that he's just a little one of God's people. He's just shorter than I am. And that he deserves the same courtesy and the same respect and the same dignity as anybody who's as tall as I am or taller deserves. And we have a very loving relationship, and I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. I heard a speaker end his pitch one night by saying, God bless you, and I don't get it. I look around a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know that we all have the same story. We just acted it out a little bit differently. We all came from that place out there where we were dying of the disease of alcoholism. We all came from that place of isolation and loneliness, and we didn't know that's where we were. I came from the streets, and I was dying. I like to tell a story about the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him to a room, and it says hell on it, and he opens it up, and inside the room there's tables and tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you'd ever want, any kind of food you could ever imagine. And the people that were in that room were starving and they were dying. And the reason that they were hungry is they had long wooden spoons tied to their hands and the spoons were just a little bit too big and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. So they sat amongst plenty and they were dying. And that's how I was out on the streets. I sat amongst plenty and I was dying. And then he took him to a room that said heaven on it, and inside that room was exactly the same setting, tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you can imagine, any kind you'd ever want to eat. And those folks had those spoons on their arms too, and they were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite reach their mouth. But the people in that room were full, and they were content, and they were happy. And the difference was in that room, one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the person across the table. And the person across the table was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the man next to him. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here and I have to let you feed me. And hopefully every once in a while I can give a spoonful of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous away to somebody else. And you don't have to wait till you're 100 years sober. If you've got one day of sobriety, if you know how to live 24 hours without taking a drink, you have something to offer to the man or the woman walking in the door. And you have something to give them, and you have some hope. I took a woman to a meeting one night, and it was her first night, and she was about 3 hours away from her last drunk, and she was dying. And she sat in that meeting because she wanted to be sober more than she wanted to drink. And she went to 2 meetings the next day and 2 meetings on Saturday. And I had the privilege of being in a meeting with her on Sunday, and she had 3 days of sobriety. And there was a woman sitting across the table from us, and it was that lady's first day, and she was shaking and she was dying. And my friend with 3 days of sobriety reached across the table and took her hand. She said, honey, she said, you don't have to be afraid anymore. She said, we're in a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, I don't know what's going to happen to us here. She said, but I believe that if we go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and don't drink, that we won't get drunk. And if we don't get drunk, our life will get different. And I'm happy to tell you that both of those ladies are sober tonight. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Because of your experience in being sober, you give me the hope that I can stay sober one more day. And so when I hear somebody say, God bless you, I don't get it. Because I believe that we as a group of people have already been blessed. I wish I had a message for the newcomer, but I don't. I wish I could tell you something that would mean something to you, but I have no message. The only thing that I know, we've already heard tonight. The only thing I know for a fact, from my own experience, we heard when Chapter 5 was read. And that is, that there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.